Albert, welcome to Validated.
Hey, Austin. Good to be here.
Yeah. I want to talk about a lot of things today, but I want to start out with GameFi and blockchain gaming as a category. This has been something people have been talking about for a very long time. I think this is one of the sort of, it's not quite the OG use case that payments is, but it's up there as sort of, we need to decentralize games. Blockchain can really play a huge part in this. The thesis has been true for a very long time, but it's felt like blockchain gaming is going to come next year for probably the last 4 years. So where actually are we right now in the journey of GameFi and blockchain gaming?
I think we're getting really close. For us over here at Genopets, we've been building since 2021, and there is a lot of other projects that built alongside us and with different philosophies on what Web3 means for gaming. There are people who believe that Web3 should be completely on-chain. So these are, I think, games that are called fully on-chain worlds. Those have their own place, and those skew towards the audience that are Web3 native. For us at Genopets, we believe that the main use case of Web3 gaming and consumer applications in general is the flywheel effect when the users become both the demand side and the supply side of the business. So in the case of games, we think that it means instead of buying these game items, in-game assets from game publishers, players are buying them from other players and players are creating it themselves. And that's how you create a flywheel effect. Because prior to Web3, most games are, all games in general have the model where the publishers create in-game assets and content. And then consumers do one thing and they just consume it and buy. And it works well for a lot of the games out there. But for Web3 gaming, we're turning this around and we call this the player-owned economy.
Yeah. So I want to get into a lot of how this works, because I think we all know, one of my early experiences with online games was buying World of Warcraft gold from eBay, which is a very funny experience, right? But that's 20 years ago, effectively. You saw games like EVE Online be able to create, very long tail, like almost decade long game experiences because there was a company printing money in the middle there getting revenue. The Second Life, I'm not sure if it's still around today, but it had quite a run because it had a hybrid model where some of the revenue went to the people in the game and some of the revenue actually went to sort of the game developer side of things. So in this world of players transacting with players directly, how do you deal with the, quite frankly, logistics and long-term economics that games still need servers and game developers still need to exist to keep the games going?
I think that's the dichotomy there is basically what I mentioned before. Are we talking about games that are fully on-chain or games that use Web3 as a conduit for the in-game economy? And for us, we believe in the latter. So I will speak to the latter. And I don't think for Genopets or other games in our category, we believe that the game should be fully decentralized. I think there's still a role for the publisher to manage servers, to create the mobile game or the desktop game for people to consume. Now, the difference is with Web3 economy, there are a few things you can do. You can have token governance for the content. And then as part of that governance, you can decide on the cost for creating these items and the cost for burning these items or the use cases for these items. So that's what we actually have going and will have in the future. Most of the settings for economic sinks for our items and the crafting recipes to create these items are all on-chain and upgradable and can be governed. So in that case, I think to answer your question, to make it balanced, we want a very specific part of the game, which is the economic side of the game, to be decentralized and governed by the players. But everything else, we keep it as part of the publishers.
Nice. So I want to get into a bunch of how you guys are tying into Solana DeFi and all those sorts of things. But before we get into that, just give me an overview of Genopets. What is the sort of gameplay style? How do folks get involved? And how long has the game actually been live?
Cool. Yeah. So Genopets is a gamified habit app that rewards players for living a healthy lifestyle. So you raise a digital pet powered by steps that you take every day. So think Tamagotchi or Pokemon Go. You take care of it by taking care of yourself. You customize it, and then you use your pet to compete against other players. Now, you can level up and upgrade your pet with various items and in-game assets such as augments, boosts, cosmetic skins. Like I was mentioning before, these items are crafted by other players in the Web3 side of a game. And the Web3 side of a game is an optional expansion pack, so to speak. Mm. So we created economy this way so that the mobile players are the buy side and the mobile app experience is mostly a Web3 invisible experience. And then there's a Web3 crafting side that's on our website where you can play to earn and you can craft and mint assets to sell to the wider player base. And that part is optional.
I want to get into how that works. I think your instinct there of like, we have to abstract away a lot of the Web3 side to get consumers engaged is super right, right? I think that's what we've seen. You know, Stepin had a similar approach, which was quite successful. We've even seen a lot of folks like Baxis having a very similar approach where they're doing something very different with whiskey as an asset class, but the Web3 part of it is sort of abstracted away. So talk to me a little bit about that interface between the folks who know this is built on blockchain, they know how it works, they're, you know, storing their digital assets in actual blockchain wallets, and the folks that are downloading it thinking it's sort of any other classic, you know, Web2 mobile game experience.
Yeah, so we've made our mobile app, like you said, completely Web3 invisible. It could pass as any other app. The only difference is when you go into the shop section of the mobile app, you're buying from other players, not from the publisher. So the idea is that most consumers of mobile apps don't need to or even want to understand the complexity of setting up their wallet, making transactions on chain, etc., until they're absolutely ready.
Yeah.
So the experience feels like this. In the mobile app, there's no crypto. You go in. When it's your first time, you summon your Geno pet. You start taking care of it. When you want to start upgrading your pet or buying food for your pet, we have an in-game currency called Qubits, which is basically a wrap version of USDC. But the players don't really know that. It just looks and feels like any in-game currency for other Web2 games. Now, and similar to other Web2 games, this is also purchased via regular in-app purchase. So for those that don't play games on mobile, think Apple Pay. So you just double-click your lock button, and then you can pay via your linked credit card. So after you do that, you get these in-game currency that we call Qubits. Now, with the Qubits, we've partnered with a Solana project called CoinFlow to make it so that every purchase of Qubits is mapped with a corresponding USDC wrapping on chain. So these Qubits can be used to purchase on-chain assets in the background for the player. On the other side, there's a Web3 part of the game. So on our website, we built an on-chain marketplace for in-game assets. We built it on Phoenix Dex. So that's something I would talk about. Love Phoenix when they first launched last year. I was looking at it for a while. But anyway, this marketplace functions just like any NFT marketplace. You buy and sell any in-game assets. You connect your wallet. You list. You buy. Done. Very simple for Web3 natives. On the mobile app, these listings become viewable, but the prices appear as qubits. So when a player purchases the item in the game, it feels like purchasing an in-game asset sold by the publisher.
Right.
But in the background, the ask on the order book is actually taken on-chain. And the marketplace fees and everything are swapped to our native token Gene as a buyback. And this is all done in all one atomic transaction to make it feel as close to a Web2 experience as possible.
So how much of this is intentional design choice and how much of this is dictated by the duopoly of app stores?
That's a really good question. I think it's a little bit of both, but the duopoly of the app stores plays a significant role in us making Qubits a in-app purchased currency. I think without the App Store or Google Play Store rules, we would probably still go this way. But the difference is, instead of in-app purchase, we probably would just ask them for their credit card or use MoonPay or some kind of on-ramp for it.
Right, because there's effectively a 30% tax on the Qubits.
Correct. So the qubits that you get, that is correct. And it's really, really great that you mentioned it right away. So the qubit serves as a interface in which you kind of abstract that away, right? So the qubits are not one-to-one to USD. So when you're buying, I think, $2 of qubits, you're getting 4,000 qubits. And we have our internal way of mapping that to USDC. But essentially, when you do that, you're getting taxed by the App Store of 30%. And that's taking out.
And so the qubit component, there's nothing blockchain about that. That's just any old in-game point system, correct?
Yes and no. So like as part of the mobile experience, it's just like points. But in the back end, we actually use CoinFlow to create these credits on chain. So every time it happens, we wrap USDC.
Okay.
We wrap USDC in a custom account that we can then use to compose transactions later.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you guys are actually, because the way I sort of assume, I think most people might assume this works, is I buy qubits with my credit card, Apple takes their 30% cut, and then when, you know, I take these qubits and go buy something that's actually coming on chain from, you know, Phoenix or another DeFi order system, you're basically filling at that point from cash reserves. But you guys actually go ahead and secure USDC on chain to basically make that one atomic transaction.
Yeah, you could absolutely do that as well, basically serving as a centralized exchange in a way.
Yes.
The way we were thinking about it is that we want as little of that complexity as possible. And the closer you can get to a non-custodial experience, the better for both development purposes and just for user experience purposes. So we call this approach the semi-custodial approach because we're doing things using their wallet, but we're not actually, we don't actually own the wallet, and it's not, the transactions aren't taking place in a centralized ledger. It is actually just being done on chain. So we don't have to reconcile that. And after what FTX happened, we really think that's the way to do things, as if you can make that happen.
Yeah, I kind of love this as an example of how you can build things on blockchain that are actually more efficient than if you had to do sort of the Web2 counterpart. Because if you guys could be running a giant peer-to-peer asset trading system that used these qubits and credits and actually had no blockchain involved, but there would just be a lot of custody risk for you as a company at that point. And it's pretty cool that you guys have been able to drive away that people can still pay with in-game purchases through the app store, but, you know, fundamentally what they're dealing with is something that is backed up by a blockchain.
Yeah, we really think that's important. You know, I've been in the space since 2017, and for the longest time, we're talking about how do you make the user experience friendly for Web2 players, because having to buy tokens and having to set up a wallet is a lot of barrier to entry. So to get that through, you have to dangle like the earning side of things in front of them. So you have the incentive to actually go through all of that. But our idea is that there's a huge amount of other users, potential users that you can onboard into Web3, but they're not ready from the get-go. So this is kind of like a Trojan horse for Web3. You get them into a game that seems familiar, but then, you know, it's semi-custodial. And if they want to and are interested in self-custody, there's an option for it.
So I want to talk a little bit about the on-chain DeFi side of things. You guys are using Phoenix primarily, but are you tying into other pieces of Solana DeFi as well?
Yeah, we use Orca as well for just AMM swaps for buyback of the Gene token with marketplace fees. So these are the two main protocols that we compose right now.
Yeah, so what was the decision to pick Phoenix? Phoenix is built a little bit different than a lot of the other DEXs and order books on Solana.
Yeah, so this is a great story because to start, I have to talk about how our in-game assets are represented. So we use semi-fungible tokens, SFTs, for our in-game assets. These are slightly different from NFTs, non-fungible tokens, in that there are many of the same one. And we use this for in-game assets because in the gaming world, there are a lot of items that are indistinguishable from other versions of itself, right? For example, if you have a golden ticket, then every other golden ticket is actually the same, aka fungible, with itself. So there's really no need to create a massive amount of NFTs if they all represent the same thing. And it makes it a lot easier to compose in DeFi. This is actually also a standard. It's also called fungible asset. It's a standard set by one of the standards set by Metaplex and also the digital assets API, the DAS API. Yeah. So because we've made the early decision to represent our in-game assets as semi-fungible tokens, we had very limited options for creating the marketplace. We couldn't use a regular NFT marketplace. And back in 2021, when we started, Serum was the only real option. And you had other projects such as Star Atlas that just built their entire in-game asset marketplace on Serum. And around middle of 2022, we partnered with Magic Eden and Bonfita to create Serum V4. That's a version of Serum that takes into account creators' royalty. And even today, if you go on Magic Eden and go to their semi-fungible token section, that composes Serum V4. Now, I actually met the founders of Phoenix at Breakpoint 2022. And I remember the first thing I asked was, what makes Phoenix different from Serum? And the number one thing is, it's crankless. Now, for most people, that might not mean a lot, right? But for us, it's huge, because in order to get as close to a Web2 experience as possible, you need to make things, make transactions as atomic as possible. And also, if you're grabbing all these sources of accounts and data and composing with all these different DeFi protocols, you need the transaction to be atomic and composable. So the term that, you know, we've heard people use for a while now is atomic composability. The term is thrown around a lot, but it actually has huge user experience implications for consumer apps and gaming. In Serum, you had to crank it. So there was no way to know whether your transaction, what price your purchase settled at until the crank passes. And that's very different from a Web2 experience. So basically you send a transaction and then you kind of wait. Maybe it doesn't take that long, but from our experience, it takes about like 5 to 10 seconds before you know, oh, okay, so that's how it's settled. So Phoenix, really, there's a lot of good things about it, but this is the number one reason we chose Phoenix, because with it being crankless, you can actually finish an atomic purchase instruction and then add other things, other instructions within it, and that whole thing becomes one atomic transaction, leading to a really good Web2-like user experience.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about transaction formation and sort of this process here, because one of the things with Solana transactions is they're CU limited in a way that on slower networks like Ethereum, a transaction can spiral out and do lots of things. Yeah. Now that transaction might cost $20 to execute, and it might, you know, you might have to wait a minute or two to know it's actually confirmed. But what sort of design decisions did you have to make to build something like this on Solana?
It's interesting that you mentioned compute budget, because we've been building since 2021 and we were growing while Solana was growing as well.
Yeah.
Solana in the past 2 years have made so many improvements that facilitated the ability to do atomic transactions. So in early 2022, the main bottleneck was compute budget, because there at that time, there was no compute budget increase instruction. It was feature gated for until like, I think, middle of 2022. So we couldn't do it back then. And then after that was passed, then you can start creating transactions with compute budget increase. So you can do transactions with huge compute, but then you have another bottleneck, which is the transaction size, because of the MTU limit and everything, is relatively small. And I think something like 40 accounts or 50, I forget the exact number, but you had a limit of the number of accounts that you can pass in, which is a direct bottleneck for something that we wanted to do. Because if you wanted to do an Orca swap and a Phoenix DEX swap and unwrapping the USDC on a CoinFlow program all in the same transaction, we need about 50 to 60 accounts. And that's just not possible.
Right.
So later on, as you probably know where I'm going with this, version zero transactions came along, and you're now able to use lookup tables to decrease the size 32-fold, right? So
yes.
Any account that's on your lookup table now takes 1 byte instead of 32 bytes. That was huge. As soon as that happened, that's when we realized, okay, this is possible to create like one transaction that uses a swap on Orca, a swap on Phoenix, and an unwrapping on CoinFlow. So that was really exciting for us. And that was the moment we realized, you know, it's only possible on Solana.
Love it. So what is not possible today on Solana that you wish was?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there's a lot of room for improvement. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but the biggest pain point right now is how composability works, right? So when you want to interact with another program right now, you basically need their SDK. You can't just go take their IDL and just do things with it, because account resolution is really a problem, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what these accounts are. The SDKs usually will help you figure that out, or their documentation. So that's different, because for me, I also built on EVM back in the day. That's not something you need to even think about. So I think that's a huge pain point. And also serialization of the data. Right now with Anchor, it's a lot better. Most of the protocols just use Borsch. But then, you know, when it comes to Phoenix DEX is built with native Solana. So then it's not hugely different, but then we have to actually, when we were composing it, we had to actually study how the data was serialized and deserialized and compose it that way. This is really interesting because since Solana has been making such big waves in the Web3 world, there are a lot of projects coming over, and I'm advising a few friends and other partner projects to come on. And the number one thing they ask about is, how do you do CPI? And you know, it's kind of those things that when you've been in the ecosystem for so long, this is like something that you're just used to. But then when people point out how crazy it is that you have to actually go and read the code of the protocol you're trying to compose and fully internalize it before you can start using it, that's kind of crazy. And I know, like I said all of these things, and it's probably obvious what the solution is, which is runtime V2. So I'm excited for what that entails.
Yeah, type-rich bytecode format too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's really interesting to hear you talk about this because, I mean, one of the reasons people love Anchor is it solves or it makes some of these problems easier. But the downside of Anchor is the performance hits. It's not as performant as, you know, building something natively in Solana code. So runtime V2 is absolutely one of those things that will sort of work towards making this better. But yeah. It's also interesting to see sort of how much of this you guys have still been able to build, even with some of these challenges in cross-program invocations.
Yeah, I think the main difference is that the barrier for CPI is much higher, right? Internally, we actually have engineers whose full job is to figure out the CPI. And I'll be like, okay, you know what? I want to compose this protocol. Please figure out the CPI. Tell me what accounts I need to put in. And then we'll create an internal SDK or an internal library, and that's all I have to do, right? So I think getting rid of that barrier would make composability or just projects working together much faster.
I can definitely see that. Yeah, I mean, I think runtime V2 is probably still a year away.
Yeah, it's going to be a while, but I'm excited for it nonetheless.
Yeah, there's a lot of work going into it, which is, I think, something we're all kind of excited for. To sort of hard pivot a little bit here, talk to me about user acquisition. This is one of the things that we hear routinely from games, not just Web3 games, but user acquisition is hard, that there's a pool of gamers that in some ways is growing, but is also not growing at the pace that it used to be. So how are people, especially folks who are not blockchain native, discovering GenoPets?
Yeah, so for us, I think, first of all, you're absolutely right on that front. I think in gaming in general, user acquisition, especially after Apple's change in ad policy, has been really difficult. And at the same time, gaming in general is just becoming a really saturated industry. So it's hard to get the eyeballs, right?
Yeah.
So Web3, a huge part of why Web3 is important for gaming, I personally believe, is the evangelizing of the game once players feel like this is a game that they are part owners of. So I wanted to just get that out of the way first, because there are ways to do user acquisition still in this day and age that doesn't involve Web3 or incentivization via rewards, but it's a lot more difficult. What we've constantly found is that players that come in and who are Web3 adjacent or Web3 curious and then later on creates a wallet, our data show that they retain a lot better and tend to spend more money. So as a result, I think the hard answer to that question is that Web3 is kind of the answer. But then at the same time, we can't fully rely on it because there's a lot of players out there that don't believe in Web3 as a concept and they need to be converted. So from that point, from that perspective, you know, GenoPets, for us, we're not really 100% a mobile game. We are actually a consumer habit app that takes the medium of a free-to-play game to help you live a healthier lifestyle. So for us, we don't, for regular user acquisition, we're not exactly competing for eyeballs in the gaming world. We're also competing for eyeballs in the self-care world, the wellness industry. And we've realized that we haven't fully tapped into that, but we've seen a lot of the message resonates with a lot of people. And we constantly get messages from players saying, hey, my friend recommended this app to me for me to get healthier and lose weight. And I've walked consistently 10,000 steps every day for the last two months. And then here's my results. So that's kind of like the angle that we've seen that's been pretty useful for user acquisition. And we're able to really expand that and just have people refer each other that way. I think in the coming year, we're going to tap a little more into that field in terms of user acquisition channels. But for now, this is kind of like what we find interesting.
Yeah. I want to kind of ask you a little bit of a question out of left field. Rabbit released this device they're calling the R1. And It's sort of a rethink on what the smartphone interface could be. They describe it as removing the app-centric model and switching to an LLM or an LLA, large language action model for interfacing with technology. How much of the design decisions that you've made, how much of the way you've built GenaPets is dictated by the limitations imposed on you in these very walled garden mobile ecosystems? And how would you maybe consider building the game and the product differently if you had a truly open platform to build on?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, because for Rabbit, they're envisioning a world where apps are not something that people build, but are something that the AI will give it to you on demand. Earlier on, and when we were planning on building the app, we threw around some ideas about building custom hardware to really learn everything there is about you, because steps is just the first thing that we're tracking. We aim to track sleep, heart rate, all kinds of things. And the biggest barrier that we ran into is that not everybody has these devices. So then to start, we started with the step count, because everybody can track their steps using their smartphone. Now, in a world where there's an open system and we are not tied down by the fact that everyone just has one iPhone or one Android, there's a world where we could build this as an integrated hardware system and market it a little differently, right? Instead of it being an app on your phone, maybe it's a wearable, but that's also a game inside of your wearable. These are ideas that we've thrown around internally, but obviously, given what is possible and what is the norm today, we've built a mobile app. But really interesting to think about.
So if folks want to try out the game, if folks want to actually check out some of the code you guys have made, where can they find more information about the project?
Yeah, so you can follow us on Twitter at GenoPets. If you download the game from the App Store or Google Play Store, you can enter the invite code Validated, and you'll get some free food and toys for your pet. On our Twitter, we infrequently publish our technical achievements, so I think that's a good place to start. Or you can join our Discord, and I'm in there a lot, and I talk about the tech we've built.
Awesome. Well, Albert, this has been fascinating. This got a lot more deep technically than I was expecting it to. Really glad we went into a lot of those details on how you guys actually built this thing, and thanks for coming on Validated.
Amazing, yeah. You know, it's funny because a lot of times people think GameFi and they immediately dive into gameplay and gaming, in-game economy and all sorts of things. But there's a lot of tech involved in composing DeFi and Web3 gaming. So I'm glad to be here and shed light on that.
Awesome.
So thank you, Austin.
Validated is produced by Ray Belli with help from Ross Cohen, Brandon Ector, Amira Valiani, and Ainsley Medford. Engineering by Tyler Morissette.